Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Sasha Pfeiffer, and this is On Point. Best-selling author Ann Patchett recently decided to take up a challenge. No shopping for a year. No frivolous shopping, that is. She would buy only what she needed. Groceries? Yes. Some books, since she's a lover of writing, but no new clothing, no luxury gadgets like speakers, no new shampoos or moisturizers unless she ran out of them. She was inspired by a friend who did her own no shopping year after a trip to India. And today, Ann Patchett joins us to talk about how difficult that was in our highly consumer culture and what she learned from the process. This hour on Point, rethinking what we need versus what we want. And joining me now from Nashville, Tennessee, is Ann Patchett, the international best-selling author of numerous novels, including Bel Canto, State of Wonder, most recently Commonwealth, their wonderful books. She's also the co-owner of Parnassus Books in Nashville. You can find a link to Ann's piece, which is headlined My Year of No Shopping, at our website, onpointradio.org. Ann Patchett, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Sasha.
And Ann, for those listeners who have not read your essay yet, give us a little background, because this friend who inspired you actually told you about this years ago, but it took you several years to try it yourself.
Yeah. My friend Elisa Kim in 2009 told me about her no shopping year. And I thought, wow, you know, that would be so hard. That's so interesting. And I played around with it a little bit in the intervening years. I gave up shopping for Lent a couple of times, and I was always surprised by how much better it made me feel, sort of like when you give up sugar or something, you just think, wow, it was really hard, but now I feel so much better. But it wasn't until 2017, January 1st of 2017, that I really thought, I'm going to go in, do the whole thing for a year. And it had to do with a couple of different things. I think it had to do with the state of the country and feeling like there was this real drive towards everything materialistic. And it had to do with feeling like I just had enough. Also, I had gotten really in deep on a couple of shopping websites, and I just found that I was just looking at stuff, because an important part of a no shopping year is it's not just about no buying. It's really about no shopping. It's about not chilling out by looking at websites and thinking, oh, you know, do I like those shoes? Do I want this? Do I want that? That was the habit that I really wanted to break.
And that really is a habit I'm sure many people may not even realize they have, the kind of idle browsing online, particularly for the sales section of the, what's the clearance section? And often that browsing obviously leads to buying. You click, you've bought, later you think, did I need this? Why did I buy this?
Yeah, and I had no idea I wanted it. It's kind of like catalogs. I find that if I can just throw the catalog directly into the recycle bin, I don't want anything in that catalog. But if I take up the catalog like a magazine or a newspaper and think, oh, I'm going to really just look at this. I'm going to have my breakfast and thumb through the J.Crew catalog. By the end, I have dog-eared several pages, and there are things that I not only want, but I think I actually need to have.
Ann Patchett, the friend who inspired you to do your year of no shopping is Elisa Kim, and she is with us on the line from Denver, Colorado, where she's a political campaign manager out there. And again, she's the person who planted the seed in your mind and eventually got you to emulate what she was doing. Elisa Kim, welcome to On Point. And tell us how the no shopping rules worked for you and why you did this so many years ago.
Hi, Elisa. Sure.
Hi, Ann. How are you?
Good. And
thank you, Sasha, for letting me join here.
Sure.
Yeah, so the idea was first hatched on my first trip to India. I witnessed poverty beyond anything I had ever seen before. And so as you walk those streets, you know, I just felt in too many moments like the most obscenely rich person in the world. I mean, someone swimming in material goods while so many people went without. And so on the last day of the trip, over breakfast, my friend Chris Khalil and I started working out my anxiety over this. It's just asking questions of why wasn't I doing more? How could I do more? What does it look like to do more? And that's how we landed on the idea. I mean, it was sort of a joke at first of just, wow, well, I could do more if I didn't fritter so much money away on frivolities. But then we started exploring the idea and realized, wait, that's just true. If I didn't buy shoes, clothes, bags, jewelry, then I would free up.
Elisa,
other people.
Give us your rules. You had to buy some things, right? What things were strictly off limits and what were there loopholes for?
Yeah, so the shoes, clothes, bags, jewelry were the rules. And I was allowed two exceptions that year that Chris would get to arbitrate and decide on. And then what I ended up finding, which is I think what Anne describes well in the essay, is that it ended up extending though to a lot of different things because it does change the contours of your brain and how you think about material goods. But the technical rules were just those four things.
So Anne Patchett, when you decided to make your own rules, you knew that they, as you put it, couldn't be so draconian that just a month or two into the pledge you would bail. So tell our listeners what you decided you had to allow room to buy and what you decided was off limits.
Well, I had to buy food. I travel a lot for work, and so certainly I would go to restaurants. I would buy plane tickets. And the idea is that if I ran out of something, you know, if I needed D batteries and I didn't have any D batteries, you know, I could go and get those. But I have enough skirts. And that was sort of it. If it was something small and I was completely out of it or it was food, I could buy it. But everything else, I really didn't buy.
And there's a funny part in your essay where you ran out of lip balm, but then you started reaching in pockets and thought, oh my, I have enough lip balm to get me well beyond the year.
Yeah, you know, it was really funny. The Daily Mail in England picked this piece up, and I was out of the country. And so they had tried to get in touch with me, and they couldn't get in touch with me. And they just cut the article up and made it look like they had interviewed me. But the title, the headline for the piece was, "Woman Discovers Five Chapsticks." It was the most heinous thing they could say about me, that I had five chapsticks I didn't know about. But it's true. I mean, the things that I would think, well, gosh, you know, I need hair product. I have really crummy hair. I need hair product. I didn't think I should have bought hair product and stocked up on it. And then I went under the bathroom sink and looked, and it turns out that all these years I've been buying hair product and not liking it and not throwing it away, but just tossing it under the sink. And I think that I could probably do this experiment for about another 5 years before I had to buy.
Well, you also
really,
wrote,
frankly, anything.
Right. And you wrote that you kind of bought into the idea that a hand cream could make a real difference in your life. You know, that idea that if I buy this cosmetic, it's going to change everything. It will reverse the aging. And you realized you had to break that habit, too.
Well, and that actually has been interesting because I'm going to re-up for another year, and I'm sure we'll talk about this at some point, but I've not picked it up again in 2018. And I really have thought, okay, well, if I gave myself 3 days or a day or whatever to shop and buy what I needed, I could buy anything I wanted today, and then I'd get back on the train. And what do I want? And it is all product. It's all like face cream, shampoo, hand cream. The stuff that I absolutely don't need. And so that's just been interesting. Like, okay, I'm not going to do it, but isn't it strange that after a year, the stuff that I'm still craving is the stuff that I still have gallons of?
I want to play a piece of sound from Mad Men, the TV series, in which Don Draper, the very successful ad man on Madison Avenue, played by John Hamm, explains to a client what makes an ad campaign successful.
Advertising is based on one thing. Happiness. And you know what happiness is? Happiness is the smell of a new car. It's freedom from fear. It's a billboard on the side of the road that screams with reassurance that whatever you're doing, it's okay. You are okay.
Happiness is the smell of a new car, he says. And one more piece of sound. This is just a bit of a sort of a Macy's ad for an after Christmas sale that ran just last week.
It's Macy's after Christmas sale. Take an extra 20% off with your Macy's card or savings pass. During our biggest bedding and bath white sale, save up to 70%. Plus, shop thousands of new markdowns in-store and online. Now at Macy's.
So Ann Patchett and Lisa Kim, everywhere all around us is this societal message that new things bring happiness. The smell of the new car, that clothing that hasn't even been in the washing machine yet. Everywhere around us, ads and sales. It's a lot to resist. Did you find that you had to break a psychological barrier to get past not wanting new things constantly?
Lisa, you go.
Yes, I mean, I think that that is what largely triggered the action. Is that, like Anne, I found myself just spending a lot of time and energy exploring different options, buying options, and it's deceptive. You think that you will be happier if you have that new sweater, that new item, and then quickly you realize 3 days later you don't even remember you bought it, and so you know this, and yet you still get deceived and you still fall into it. And for me, I couldn't do it any other way except just to say nothing at all. And so yes, I do think that we're susceptible to that. And it's so visual, and it's so stimulating, and there's audio, and there's visual, and you can be fooled very quickly. But of course, we all know deep inside, it's pretty empty.
And Ann Patchett, how much did you feel like you were resisting societal forces to do this year of no shopping?
I think that in a lot of ways it's easier for me because I don't watch television, where so many of those messages come to you through television. I'm also a pretty low internet person. So I found that if I just didn't go into the stores and I didn't open the catalogs, I was surprised by how little I wanted. But I think also, it's about craving. To be human is to crave more, to want more, and to realize that getting more doesn't make the craving go away.
Ann Patchett, stay with us. Elisa Kim, stay with us as well. We're going to take a break, but we'll be back again discussing a year of no shopping, which items are important, which are not. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. This is On Point.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS ConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
Hey, it's Guy Raz here, host of How I Built This, with the recommendation for another podcast for you to check out, namely How I Built This. Every week, I talk to the people behind some of the most inspiring companies and brands in the world, with stories of incredible persistence, grit, and insight. You can find How I Built This on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. We're talking with Ann Patchett and Lisa Kim about each of their years of no shopping. My guests today, again, are Ann Patchett and Lisa Kim. Ann is the best-selling author of numerous novels and numerous works of nonfiction and the winner of the Penn Faulkner Prize. You can find her piece headlined My Year of No Shopping at our website, onpointradio.org. And with us from Denver is Lisa Kim, Ann's friend who inspired her to go a year without shopping. Ann and Lisa, we have a number of listeners who want to weigh in, so let's hear from several of them. Jonathan is calling from Pasadena, California. Jonathan, your thoughts about the idea of not shopping frivolously for a year?
Hi, Sasha. Thanks for taking my call. I am the zero waste guy. I live, breathe, advocate for living a low waste lifestyle. I was really just like obsessed with what other people had. I was very envious. I was jealous. I always wished I had what they did because I looked at that as a measure of success. So when I started living a zero waste lifestyle, I found that I just stopped buying stuff for the sake of buying it. And now I just have very few items. Everything that I have has value and meaning to me. I repair clothing. I try to buy products and food as locally as possible, as high quality as possible, just to minimize the amount of stuff that I have. And I save a lot of money as a result and feel very empowered and very, very good.
And how did you get over the envy aspect, in a sense, that you used to feel about what other people had and you didn't?
I just made this determination that I was going to stop doing it, stop spending money. I saw my bank account not doing very well. And once I got over that hump and stopped buying things, I was just saving so much money and feeling so much, so empowered because the items that I had were meaningful to me and high quality.
Jonathan, thank you for that call. Let's also hear from Patricia, who's calling from Baxter Springs, Kansas. Patricia, welcome to On Point and your thoughts about whether you could go a year without shopping.
Thank you. Hi. Actually, what I'm calling about is that this, I don't understand what there is such an oddity about this. I'm a senior, and this has been my lifestyle of necessity for several years. And I just, you know, from month to month, I wonder, am I going to have enough money to pay my utilities? And this month, they were like twice the amount. I just don't buy. I get the necessary things that I have to eat, to pay for my laundry. I'm living in low-income housing. And I think that we overlook the seniors that are living like this. This is their necessary lifestyle.
Patricia, thank you for that. And I will have Alisa and Anne weigh in on that. But let's take one more caller before we hear their perspectives. This is Lauren calling from Iowa City, Iowa. Lauren, welcome to On Point.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I guess I just think that this is a really precious project for people who are wealthy enough to make it their project. But after 10 years of non and underemployment, I wonder how they would feel after they have done that for so long and they don't have the coats that they need or the shoes that they need and their clothes are shabby. And I just wonder what it would be like, how their social circle would look at them when they didn't have the things that were just the bare necessities in life and they weren't able to be regarded as somehow saintly for doing something that was some big sacrifice.
Lauren, thank you for that. And Anne and Alisa, that is certainly a theme that you're aware of and that we're hearing from our listeners online as well. Someone on Twitter writes, first world problems about this idea. Another person on Facebook writes, I did this for decades. It's called poverty. So how do you reconcile the idea that you could choose not to buy things when some people have no choice simply because they don't have enough income to buy things?
Well, I think that this is exactly where Alisa's idea came from. And for me, I think that it's what everybody is saying is absolutely true. And there is something precious about my doing it. And I have money and I can buy what I want. But if you stop, I found that what happened is that instead of always looking ahead of what might I want, what might be out there, if I cut that off, what I could do is basically look behind and think about what other people don't have. If I'm not always thinking about what I might want, it's a lot easier for me to see what other people don't have. And there's no way in the world I think that doing this for a year, you know, makes me at one with the poor. But it sure was a wake-up call to me about how to be helpful and about how to spend my money in ways that were helpful and compassionate to other people instead of spending my money on J. Crew sales.
And Alisa Kim, as the inspiration for Ann Patchett to do this, you had a similar revelation that when you did less shopping, it freed up time, it freed up money, and you then could decide how would you spend that time and money. How did you choose to do that?
Yeah, so, well, first I want to acknowledge what others said. I do hear that loudly and clearly, and I echo what Anne also noted. I mean, for me, I think that's exactly what the animating force was, which is this idea that I do have a lot. I acknowledge that. And it never felt that way when I was here. But when you go somewhere else and you're confronted with your abundance, then it does trigger a different way of thinking, acting in the world, and makes you want to do something. And so, you know, for me, I think that it became what Duhigg calls a keystone habit. And so it does, like, you stop shopping, you become more aware of what you have and what others do and do not have, how you can contribute to the world in more meaningful, helpful ways. And it also changes your lifestyle. You know, it's silly things, honestly. So the fact that I didn't shop actually caused me, even though I still had clothes, I still had a closet full of things, I found myself actually just wearing the same things over and over and over because I no longer wanted to spend any time thinking about it. And you quit doing all the laundry, you quit doing all this. So all of a sudden, you know, like one habit change triggers many other changes in your lifestyle. And it does enable you then to give back more, to think in different ways, to figure out how you could help others.
Let's go to another caller. This is Philippe calling from Baltimore, Maryland. Philippe, welcome to On Point. And what do you think about this idea of eliminating frivolous shopping?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I actually just wanted to call and say thank you. I think it's it's definitely a need that I think a majority of Americans don't realize they can really utilize. I personally have started to declutter and to stop purchasing things over, I would say, maybe about a year and a half. And one of the things that it actually does a lot, but it allows you to focus on your finances, to reallocate things. So for those who are, you know, trying to build, work their way out of debt, it actually provides that financial freedom. But another, I guess, kind of byproduct that I hadn't realized is that, you know, when you're making those purchases, even if you, you've done it over years and years, it becomes a distraction. And so when you stop doing those things, it allows you to be financially, emotionally available for people in ways that you hadn't realized previously. So for the ladies that are actually, you know, starting this project or, you know, anybody who's listening in, I highly encourage it. I think it's fantastic.
Philippe, thanks for that call. And I want to play a piece of sound from a financial journalist who also decided not to do any shopping. Her name is Michelle McGaugh. She says she saved more than $37,000 because she stopped her recreational shopping for a year in the year 2016. And she talked about what she learned in a TED Talk that she gave in February last year.
I used to shop probably for the same reasons you do. Because the thing that I was buying I thought would make me better looking or more interesting or cooler or just better somehow, that we could somehow buy a better life. And I think that that lie is really pervasive in our sort of quick fix culture. And I've changed. I'm more outgoing. I'm more adventurous. I say yes more. And I know what's important to me. And I can tell you categorically that it's not things.
Ann Patchett and Elisa Kim, I want to bring in another guest, and that is Tim Kasser. He's joining us from Galesburg, Illinois. He's a professor and chair of psychology at Knox College. His academic focus is on materialism and well-being. Tim Kasser is also the author of the forthcoming book, Hypercapitalism, The Modern Economy, Its Values, and How to Change Them. Tim Kasser, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Sasha.
We just heard that piece of sound in which a woman described how transformational it was for her when she really cut back on her shopping. Why is there so much psychology to this? Why do people find it something they really need to wrestle with so much difficulty?
Well, I think one of the main reasons is that we're very much socialized into thinking that making money and buying stuff is going to solve lots of our problems in life. You know, so just like people are socialized into boys act this way and girls act that way, or socialized into religious beliefs or political beliefs, they're also socialized into an economy. And our particular economy is one which tells us that profit is important, that economic growth is important, that materialistic values for having stuff is important, and that you know, having the right image, which is almost always mediated through buying stuff, is important. And so you're subject to that, especially nowadays, from birth, the way that marketers go after children. And that's become a part of most people's identities. And so it's always hard to kind of go counter to your identity and counter to your socialization, especially when so much time and effort and money, marketing money, is put into making you believe that.
One of our producers pulled a piece of sound from the TV show Black Mirror, and it's an excerpt that shows what happens when consumerism and advertising are taken to the extreme. In this episode, there's a society of people that live in this enclosed, automated space where the walls are covered with video screens, and the screens show video ads that encourage people to buy accessories for their virtual avatars called doppels. Here's a scene in which Bing Madsen, who's played by Daniel Kaluuya, rails against how superficial the world he inhabits is.
We're so out of our minds with desperation, we don't know any better. All we know is fake fodder and buying. It's how we speak to each other, how we express ourselves is buying. Well, I have a dream. The peak of our dreams is a new hat for our doppel. A hat that doesn't exist. It's not even there. We buy. It's not even there. Show us something real and free and beautiful. You couldn't. Yeah? It'd break us. We're too numb for it.
Now, this is a bit of a spoiler alert, but the twist in this episode is that even after that impassioned monologue, he does end up selling out in the end. And, you know, when he talks about buying things for his virtual avatar, you know, you can go to an American Girl doll store and buy money at the hair salon to have the hair done on the doll. So we are surrounded by this. How, Tim Kasser, do people break that kind of conditioning?
Well, there's a lot of different ways that the research has started to investigate. So one of the most important things, I think, has already been alluded to by Anne and Elisa and by this, is to stop your exposure to this. So one of the things we know is that not only does exposure to advertisement and other kinds of marketing messages increase how much people kind of buy into materialistic values, but it acts as a trigger of those values. And so if you set aside, it's sort of like an alcoholic who says, well, I'm not going to go to the bar because that would be a stimulus that reminds me that, oh, I could drink. If we set aside those stimulus or those stimuli and don't expose ourselves to them and don't expose our children to them, that's one really important way that the research has shown that we can overcome that conditioning. A second thing that works well, and that works especially well with children, the research shows, is when you are still exposed to advertisements, because you're going to be in this culture, right? You can't cut yourself off. But is to have a different attitude towards them. So when my kids were little, I used to sit down and I would show them advertisements and I would say, there's one thing you need to know about this ad. They want your money. Okay, that's the purpose of the ad, is to manipulate you so that you'll buy the thing they want. And they would say, they want my money. You know, they're just these little two-year-old kids. But I was giving them a different frame to look at the advertisement through. And later, as they got older, I would teach them ways to sort of decode the advertisement, to make fun of the advertisement so as to remove its power. So that's a second important way. There's a third important way, too, which is to focus on other values. So one of the things we know is that when people are in the sway of materialistic values, and this was talked about a little bit by Ann and Lisa, when you focus on materialistic values, the research shows it actually suppresses pro-social values. Those values are in a dynamic tension with each other. They're kind of a seesaw, if you will. And as the materialistic values go up, the pro-social values go down. But the opposite is also true. So as you begin to focus more and more on pro-social values, it actually suppresses the materialistic values. And research has shown that if you get people thinking and writing and reflecting on their pro-social values, you don't even have to actually talk about materialism, but the people's materialistic values will go down and actually their well-being will go up. So those are three quick ways. There are others I could talk about if you want, but those are three quick things I'd mention.
Ann Patchett, would you weigh in here? Other practical suggestions for people about what they do to break the habit, to resist the idle online shopping? I read somewhere that some people block websites so they can't go to them, or they simply turn their phone off or put it in another room. What are practical tips for people who really want to break the habit but struggle to do it?
Yeah, maybe I'm not the best person. Maybe Tim or Elisa would be better at answering that question, because it just wasn't that hard. I mean, you just don't do it. You make a decision and you're not going to look at something. I don't need to have my computer blocked in some way for me to not go on a website to shop.
Elisa, was it any more of a struggle for you?
Yeah, no, not really. I mean, the only thing that I did was I had group accountability. You know, so my friend Chris knew that I was engaged in the project, knew that I had made a statement and a commitment to not do this, and that, you know, honestly, I just didn't want to ever break that with him.
Callers, we are discussing the A Year of No Shopping, which is an experiment that both Ann Patchett, the best-selling author, and her friend Elisa Kim, who was an inspiration to her to do this, decided to try. 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK is the number. Let us know what you think and how you feel like. If you could do this, if you had to eliminate something, what would you do? What would you miss? We would love to hear your ideas. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. This is On Point.
How much would you pay to avoid morning traffic? Why are plane tickets to Boise so expensive? And what can a tuna cannery in the middle of the Pacific tell us about taxes? I'm Cardiff Garcia, co-host of The Indicator, a new podcast from Planet Money, where in every episode, we take on a new, unexpected idea to help you make sense of the day's news. Get it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. We're talking about how we determine what's essential and what's not, especially since the new year's a time for a symbolic fresh start. Our guests today are Ann Patchett, the best-selling author and co-owner of Parnassus Books in Nashville, Tennessee. Her New York Times essay, My Hour of No Shopping, inspired this hour's conversation. And Ann's inspiration was her friend Elisa Kim, who joins us from Denver, Colorado. She's the one who gave Ann the idea to do A Year of No Shopping. Ann and Elisa, we have a number of callers who want to weigh in. Let's hear from several of them. This is Melanie calling from Franklin, Tennessee. Melanie, welcome to On Point.
Hi. I just wanted to say, I think this is absolutely wonderful. I hiked the Appalachian Trail in 2016, and for 6 months, I literally couldn't buy anything. I had to carry everything on my back. So, you know, you didn't have any room to buy any frivolous items because you have to carry everything. So when you go into town to resupply, all you can carry on your back is your food and the things you need. And when I came back, just going into a place like Target just breaks your heart because there's just so many things that we don't need.
Sure, it's that experience we often hear from returned Peace Corps volunteers who they walk into the grocery store for the first time when they're back in the U.S. and they think, how can there be so much cereal on the shelf? It's that shock of going without and then seeing the bounty. I think that's a common feeling for people who've been away. Melanie, thank you for that. Let's also go to Fred calling from Augusta, Georgia. Fred, welcome to On Point. And what are your thoughts about whether you could spend a year eliminating all frivolous spending?
Hi, Sasha. I think about this topic a lot. We are a family of six. We have four lovely small children, and I wonder about the culture that they're growing up in, especially around food. So one thing that we're trying this month is to eliminate a number of trips to the grocery store, because we find that it's very easy to be lazy and just say, oh, I don't know what to make for dinner, go to the store and buy something, or go to a restaurant and buy something. So instead, we're working to cook out of what we have and kind of, you know, enjoy that time as a family.
That's really great. That's a very good suggestion. So you found that it actually provided more personal time. It actually changed how your family interacted and what they did together?
Yes, that's right. I mean, so far we've spent more time cooking and around the dinner table, and it requires creativity, planning out eating from things that we have, you know, canned food, dried food, et cetera, that we've had in our pantry and just has been sitting there.
Fred, thank you for that. Let's take another caller. This is Rosalind from Lexington, Kentucky. Rosalind, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Sasha. Thanks. I just think it's so interesting to listen to these conversations. I don't think about shopping. I'm very satisfied with what I have and don't really want what I don't have. However, I will say, 19 years ago, I went to Vietnam and adopted a baby and brought her home. I spent 3 weeks in Vietnam, and when I came back, it almost hurt my feelings that people wanted to give my baby so much stuff because I had seen how little people there, not everybody obviously, but the street people who I interacted with the most. So I guess at some point I did make a conscious effort not to do stuff in our lives. And that lasted a very short time until she realized there was an outside world, and it had a lot of stuff, and all her friends had stuff, and she wanted it too. So now she's very consumer-oriented, and I'm not. And I'm very happy just to enjoy nature, enjoy taking a walk. I work outside. I'm a farmer. And I don't feel a need to fill my life with things. I do sometimes like to go to craft shows and enjoy what people make. And I feel like going kind of feeds my soul, watching pretty things. And then I'm happy not to bring them home with me.
Roslyn, thank you for that. You're making me think about another piece of sound that one of our producers culled for us. And she was basically looking for items being advertised that just seemed so objectively unnecessary. So she found an infomercial for what is called the perfect popcorn bowl because it sifts out unpopped kernels. So this is a clip that is showing a sampling of all the freebies the advertiser throws in during the attempt to make consumers buy that product.
Just sift, mix, and serve perfect popcorn.
Order the dishwasher-safe perfect popcorn bowl, including the siftable and the shield, for the amazing low price of $14.99.
We'll even throw in four bottles of our all-natural popcorn seasoning. A $15 value free, display separate processing. With every order, we'll also include this old-fashioned stovetop popcorn popper that makes the tastiest popcorn. A $40 value, but you'll get it free.
We have one more guest who's still with us. That's Tim Kasser, a professor and chair of psychology at Knox College, who focuses on materialism and well-being. And Tim, I think that clip really illustrates how powerful the outside forces are, to the degree that even if you're raised in a home like we just heard from our caller, eventually the outside world can overcome that, well, you're taught at home to not want things, and suddenly you do want things. So talk to us about how powerful that force is.
Well, we know from the research that it's quite powerful. There's numerous studies which show that the more television the children ingest, the more likely they are to be materialistic. The more their peers are materialistic, the more likely they are to be materialistic. Same with parents as well. So all of these different things have their influence. In 2013, I published a study where what we did was we correlated every year since the late 1960s, there have been researchers who have been asking high school students about what's important to them. And we know that materialism has been on the rise from the late 1960s through the 80s, and even today it continues to rise. And what we did was we correlated that, the percentage of kids who thought it was really important to make a lot of money, have a lot of possessions, with how much of the overall U.S. economy was based on advertising, and we found a significant positive correlation. That is, in years where a lot of the U.S. economy was based in advertising, children were more materialistic. So all of these forces are at work, and they're all at work for a single purpose, which is to make companies money. They aren't forces which care about children's well-being. They aren't forces which really care about your happiness, despite what Don Draper would say. They're forces which are focused on trying to increase profit for companies.
Elisa Kim and Ann Patchett, when the two of you found that you had more, not just money, but time, because you weren't shopping as much, you found that you could use that time as a gift to people. Can you talk a little bit about what you began to give people instead that were gifts of time that were different than going to the store and finding a knickknack or some jewelry or even a book or clothing? Elisa Kim, can you start?
Sure, yeah. So, I gave a couple different gifts that year that were basically small jars filled with pieces of paper that outline some favor. So it might be, I'll take care of your kids, or it might be, I'll clean your house, or I'll run an errand for you. And you find a few different things. Number one, people love that, that there are many people out there who would rather have your time than another material good. And you find that you're more personally fulfilled as well. And it's also, you find that it's actually more of a sacrifice. It's easier to buy things for people than to give up what I personally think is one of the most valuable things we have, which is time.
Ann Patchett, we have a listener who made a comment on Twitter and says, I love this idea, but not sure how to make it work with young children. Birthdays, Christmas. What about that practical aspect of this? Are there sometimes you for little kids, for example, you really can't get around the gift giving, or what would you advise there?
Yeah, I think that the idea is that you don't have to nail yourself down. I think it would be wonderful to try to make something. I think it would be wonderful to look at different ways to, you know, have the kid over or have a party in the celebration instead of a gift. But it's not that if you need to buy a birthday present for a child's birthday party, go ahead and do it. And then still try your best to, you know, limit your own materialism. Just don't think of it as something that if you can't be all in it, then you have to not do it at all.
We have a number of other callers. Go ahead. Tim Kasser, was that you?
If I could just jump in
sure.
on the children issue, if that's okay.
Sure.
If listeners go to newdream.org, they'll find they just released a pamphlet and that has a whole bunch of information about how to deal with the holidays in less materialistic ways. And, of course, you know, Christmas has just passed, but birthdays are coming and Christmas will come around again. So there's a lot of really good practical advice, newdream.org. I would also note that when our kids were really little, we gave them coupons for things like they could skip their vegetables and still have dessert, or we would pick up their mess instead of them having to pick it up. And even at age 2 and 3, they would run and go get those coupons and really seem to appreciate them.
And that website was newdream.org?
That's correct.
Let's go to some more callers. This is Mark calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Mark, welcome to On Point and your thoughts about the idea of spending a year not shopping recreationally or frivolously.
Hi, I'm a socialist from Omaha, Nebraska, and I just have to say I think we're having a very shallow, out-of-touch conversation about materialism and consumerism. I'd just like to challenge your guests to answer the questions. If everyone across the country adopted these practices and these behaviors overnight, I feel like our consumer economy would just collapse overnight. Our entire economy is based on the idea that people go out and buy things and stimulate the economy in that fashion, and that puts money in people's pockets and workers and all this stuff. If I just feel like I work 40 hours a week, I work more than 40 hours a week, and I'm still in debt and behind. So when I heard that one of the callers saved $37,000 a year, I almost fell out of my chair. I don't know who they're talking to. It seems like a very, a very shallow conversation about what is the goal of this type of behavior. Because, I mean, otherwise it's just, you know, me, you know, thinking, can we do this for a year and it'd be a cute thing I can talk to my friends about. But otherwise, it's just not going to be a very productive thing for me to think about over time. It just seems like a very insulting conversation in general.
So Mark, thanks for that perspective. Ann Patchett, can you weigh in on that, particularly the piece about if everyone stops shopping, does our economy fall apart?
I'm sure it does, and there's no way in the world that everybody is going to stop shopping because a couple of people have a conversation for an hour on Point. I agree that shopping is the backbone of the economy. I'm not suggesting that everyone listening stop shopping. I would just hope that people would maybe be a little thoughtful, or I am brought on as somebody who said, this is this thing I did this year, and it was interesting for me. Not that I think everybody is going to join in on it, but it's worth thinking about. That's all.
We have another caller, this one from Hartford, Connecticut. It's Dara, or Dara. Dara, welcome to On Point. Tell us your thoughts about this conversation.
Hey, Sasha. I just wanted to touch on the social media aspect of shopping addiction because, you know, it's one thing to throw a catalog directly in the recycling bin, but Facebook and Instagram are two sources of pictures and imagery and advertising that it's just amazing how targeted these cookies are and these sites. And I wondered if Anne avoided that as well. I know she said she wasn't a big social computer user, but did she include that in her article?
Sure. Let's come back to that after we hear from a few more callers so we can get a few more in before the hour ends. Lee is calling from Portland, Maine. Lee, welcome to On Point. Your thoughts about this conversation.
Hi, Sasha. Yes, I'm a nanny, so I found it very interesting about the points about children. And also, I have another issue to talk about, the emotional aspect of getting rid of your things. I went from making $50,000 to $18,000 a year, and I've been in my house for 20 years. I'm an artist. Everything has potential for me. I wish I had the money now. I've joked with my friends that I'm just this side of hoarding, and they've said, well, you might have cried.
Lee, I think we lost you. We'll try to bring you back if we can get you. Let's go to another caller. This is Lisa calling from Buffalo, New York. Lisa, welcome to On Point and your thoughts about trying to go a year without recreational shopping.
Hi, Sasha. I kind of lived this lifestyle, so it's very interesting to know that there's other people out there doing that. A couple points that I wanted to make was wants versus needs and, you know, trying to fill that need of being bigger, better, more. We focus on the basics. We have children. Our children, you know, they don't see much social media. They don't see much cable TV as far as advertisements and things like that. And when they do, you know, we're right there talking to them about what the purpose and the point of that advertisement. Just like your guest has said, it's very important to make sure that we educate our children that, no, you don't need that. You may want that, but let's talk about what the job is of this commercial. What are they doing?
Although we did hear a parent earlier say that even though she tried to raise her child with those values, ultimately the outside world won. Do you think ultimately the outside world will always win?
It's hard to say. It's really hard to say. I think if you, you know, you have to be able to give your children some of that so that when they're not, for say, 18, they're out there in the world and they're like, oh my gosh, what have my parents been hiding from me? You know, so you try to just educate as you go. And for us, it's been fairly successful. We recently took a trip to Las Vegas and our focus was on, how do you think they pay for those pretty lights? And where do you think that money comes from? And let's talk about the shops that people are turning in their stuff to get more money to go to, you know, gamble and things like that. We really try to talk about the opposite end of the spectrum when it comes to things like that. And
Lisa, thank you for that very much. And Anne, I'm sorry we have not left time for you to respond to that one call or two calls ago, but thank you to all three of you for being with us this hour. Anne Patchett, Alisa Kim, Tim Kasser, Anne, the best-selling author, Alisa, her friend who inspired her to go a year with no shopping, Tim, a professor and chair of psychology at Knox College. Thanks to all of you. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. This is On Point.